Somewhere I read something to the effect that those whom God would make saints, He first strips. And I thought for quite a while this weekend that He had His finger on me. Because I got off here at Brunswick, but my luggage all went to West Palm Beach. And I don't know whether you all know it or not, but there are no hairpins on Jekyll Island. I thought for a while I was going to have to get up here with my hair hanging down and I was going to be AA's first middle-aged hippie. But these wonderful AAs, they come to your rescue. And, of course, when I got in my room last night, I had to take off my underwear and wash it because I had to put it back on this morning. And that left me in my birthday suit, and the only thing to do was to get under the cover and look at television. And just as I would get settled, why, be a knock on the door, and I'd get up and put on a wool skirt, and I had a blouse that went over the head and zipped up the back, and I'd get all dressed and open the door, and someone would say, "We heard about you, and we wanted to come by and see if we could do anything," and I would invite them in, and they would be so nice, and then they'd leave, and I'd get unzipped and undone and get back in the bed, and there'd be another knock. And this went on, and finally dear Margaret came in and said, "Just barely open the door. Here I have a toothbrush and a nightie and a beautiful lace negligee." I felt so elegant then I didn't care if anybody came by, and nobody else came. But it all was just kind of like a bad B movie. It got here just in the nick of time, and I managed to get dressed and get here to hear Bob's wonderful talk this afternoon. So it does all work out. My name is Mary Porter, and I am an alcoholic. Now, I stand up here tonight and say those words rather glibly, and sometimes I almost forget how agonizing it was for me to say those four words, "I am an alcoholic." I couldn't say them because they went against everything that I had been taught. I had been taught that nice women don't take a drink, much less be an alcoholic. And I think it's exceedingly difficult for all of us to say it, but for women, I think it's twice as hard. I really do. We have all these barriers that we set up. You know, an alcoholic is this, I am not this, therefore I am not an alcoholic. I think we all play this game for a long time. One of mine was, "An alcoholic never eats, I always eat, therefore I am not an alcoholic. An alcoholic takes a drink first thing in the morning, I don't take the drink first thing in the morning, therefore I am not an alcoholic." And we go through all of this process of rationalizing and playing games until life finally brings us to our knees and we have to admit that something seems to be wrong. Now, it took me a long, long time to understand that I had an illness. In fact, I was in AA and sober quite a few years. I went to the Yale School of Alcohol Studies. It took all of this for me to really know and really accept the fact that I had an illness, a very complex, incurable illness, the roots of which went back to the very beginning of my life. We're told in the beginning of our AA not to ask why, just to come on in and accept the program as the best that we can. But I think it's natural, after we've been sober a few years, to look back and trying to understand ourselves and try to see some of the reasons why, some of the basic things. I don't really know, because we don't know when things happen to us. We're told the first year of our life is very important, that a lot of our character is formed at that time. But I do know now, when I look back, I see myself as a very insecure person, always. I never really felt that I was loved. I never really felt comfortable anywhere. I don't know when this started, I just always remember feeling this way, even as a very small child. I was always feeling rejected. I was very, very sensitive to this sort of thing, and I had a tremendous inferiority complex. I was so ashamed of this inferiority complex and this shyness that I tried to cover it up with a lot of poison and act like I had a lot of self-confidence, and I would usually start being aggressive before anybody could get to me and hurt me. Now, I see all of this pattern through my childhood. I was born and reared in what is known as the Bible Belt, in a small town. My parents were mechanical sort of people. You know, they were Methodists and Democrats, and when you'd ask why, they'd say, oh, it's just the only decent way to be. They were completely mechanical. Whatever their grandmother or grandfather was, this is what they were. And I never accepted these things. I always wanted to know why. So with my own family, I didn't fit. Now, when I was about 15, a very important thing happened to me. I wanted to find out what drinking was about. This was what was known as the jazz age. You know, you hear a lot about the generation gap today. Well, there's always been a generation gap, but I don't believe there has ever been one quite as great as when I grew up. Because I was reared in Victorian principles and grew up in this jazz age. Now, you just can't get any farther apart than that. But when I was 15, I had begun to read Whiz Bang. I know none of you remember that. But some of these magazines and the flappers and the hip flask and all of this sort of thing. And I wanted to find out what drinking was about. I didn't know anything about it. We didn't have it in our home at all, not even on Christmas. And I had a young friend, a young girlfriend, whose mother was a little more lenient, and I spent the night with her, and we made all sorts of arrangements for me to try drinking. And like Bob said this afternoon, for me it was curiosity. I wanted to find out what it was like. So she had a friend who was an older man, and he got the whiskey, prescription whiskey, and we got in his roadster, and the three of us drove out to a little grove outside of town, and I took my first drink. I didn't know anything about it. They handed me the bottle. I took a great big drink, and I can still feel that horrible burning sensation that went all the way down to my toes. And then I felt that wonderful glow that comes up. And I sat there a minute, and suddenly the night, oh, it was so beautiful. The stars were so pretty. I had never noticed the night looking quite like that. So I had another. And these people were so much fun, and for once I felt like that I was just very clever and very charming and very cute. This was a wonderful, comfortable feeling that I had never had before. So I took another. And another, and another. And the next thing I knew, it was morning. I was in my girlfriend's bed, lying in my own vomit. Now, this is just about the whole story. Trying to find this wonderful, marvelous thing that we all experience at a certain peak, and then being dashed down to the cold reality. I spent my entire life trying to find this wonderful thing. I'm still seeking it. But for years, I sought it through booze and pills and people and the world. And now I'm seeking it through AA. But this first experience of mine made me so ill that I thought, well, this is ridiculous. I don't know why anybody would want to drink. So I didn't touch a drop for a couple of years until I went away to college, and then I started dating a graduate student, and I was young and unsophisticated and ill at ease, and in order to fit in with the crowd, I started drinking. I had many, many blackouts all that year at college. I, too, thought it was a normal way to be. I thought everybody who drank blacked out. In fact, I never heard that term until I got into AA. But this started my life of alcoholism right then. I was never a social drinker. I never crossed an invisible line. I married this graduate student, and he, too, was an alcoholic. And we continued to drink for 10 years. This is all we knew. All of our friends drank. We only ran around with drinking people. It was a way of life. Drunkenness was a way of life, not just drinking. I was very fortunate in this marriage in some ways because of the family that I married into. They were wonderful people. They gave me the desire for knowledge. They were university people. It was an entirely different background from my own. They were broad in their thinking. They were not mechanical. And from this marriage, I benefited very much in many, many ways. My husband, of course, was a black sheep and an alcoholic, and that's why we happened to be married. But at the end of 10 years marriage, he died an alcoholic death. Now, this didn't seem to have anything to do with me, I mean, as far as my drinking was concerned, because, well, I just wasn't having the problems that he had. I was still managing to get along rather well with my drinking at this point. But then I started to work, and then my problems began. And I began to have the usual morning shakes and so forth, and drinking became a little more of a problem. I was brought up on one idea, what will people think? Not what are you, but what will people think? And when I look back, you know, it's no wonder I was insecure, because I had, as a child, I had Santa Claus watching me all the time to see how I was acting, and I had the neighbors watching me all the time. I even had an Easter bunny watching me all the time. Now, who wouldn't be insecure? And this is what God was. He was watching me all the time to see what I was going to do, and all this had an element of punishment with it. So I hear alcoholics get up and make a talk, and they say, oh, I got drunk, and I forgot all about my family, and I went off and this. Well, I never did. I worried. I worried about what people were saying and how I looked and how I was going. This didn't keep me from drinking. This just kept me from enjoying it. I kept right on drinking and worrying. But when the war was over, I was living in Louisville, and this had become quite a problem. You know, you run out of neighborhoods and you make a scene one place and then you don't want to go back. I wasn't a bedroom drinker. I was a public drinker, I'm afraid. I like people, and I like parties, and I like to go out and drink, and I didn't want to drink alone. I would if there wasn't anybody around, but I didn't choose this. So I decided that I would go to Miami, Florida. Oh, I had a lot of reasons. The weather and the sunshine, and this was part of it, I'm sure. But I think the real reason was that I knew that in Miami I could drink with more ease, that this was more an accepted way of life for women, that in Miami women could go into bars and in Louisville you couldn't. And I think this was really the reason that I moved there. And I loved it. It was geared just exactly to my speed. There was always something going on. The bars never closed, and I thought, I have found heaven. I moved into a house with a couple who had a house over on the bay. I had a room, and they always had a party going on, and they had a boat, and we'd go nightclubbing. It was just one great big fun all the time. And it was just about this time that another important thing happened in my life. I met a man who was most interesting, and he was a friend of a friend I had met from New York, and he used to come out to the house and play cards with us, and he used to go boating with us, and sometimes he would go nightclubbing with us, but he never took a drink. Now, I couldn't stand to be around teetotalers. They made me nervous, but he didn't. He didn't look down his nose and say, don't you think you've had enough or anything. He just didn't drink. And I said to him, oh, what's the matter with you? Well, why don't you take a drink? Everybody else is drinking. I thought everybody else was drunk. I don't know that they were, but I thought so. We always did. And I said, haven't you ever had a drink? And he said, "My dear young lady, I have probably had more to drink than you will ever have. I have abused the privilege. I am an alcoholic, and I cannot drink anymore." And I said, "Well, how in the world do you do that?" And he says, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, I had heard of this just vaguely. I didn't think I'd ever meet anybody that belonged. But I was interested that here was a man who used to drink, but who could go around people who were drinking, and this fascinated me. For a long time, I wondered why he came around us all the time. I think now I know. I think it was just supposed to be that way. But he told me one day that he was speaking at the AA meeting on Sunday afternoon in Miami, and it was his first year. And he asked my friend and myself if we would like to come. And we said, yes, we would. So in all the years that I lived in Miami, I think that was the only day I didn't take a drink, because I thought we weren't supposed to if we went to this meeting. And we went on Sunday afternoon. I'll never forget. We climbed up those stairs down on Northwest Southeast River Drive, whatever that street was. It was a man standing at the top of the stairs named Charlie, and he was shaking hands with everybody. "My name's Charlie. What's your name?" And when I told him mine, he said, "Are you one of us?" And I said, "Well, potentially, I guess." "Wonderful. You go over to the beach and you have yourself a ball and maybe you'll make it." And I thought, what kind of a nut is this? Well, this, of course, was a rather small meeting, and my friend made a talk, and after he sat down, they down there do like they do up in Ohio in certain places. People get up in the audience and make comments, and they say, "My name is so-and-so," and make a few remarks. Well, the most amazing thing happened. These well-dressed, well-groomed ladies stood up in the audience and said, "My name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic." I couldn't believe it. These look like decent women. And anybody who would say that. I didn't go there about my drinking. I went there just for curiosity. But that afternoon, without a drink, I felt at ease. I sort of identified with these people. And the thing that impressed me were these women. This was back in 1945. There weren't too many. And thank God they had the courage to stand up and identify themselves. When I left the meeting, they gave me some literature. And I took it home and I started to read it. And I started in with the 12 steps. And I saw prayer and meditation and God, and I thought, well, no wonder they're not drinking. They're a bunch of religious fanatics. Anybody would stop drinking if they joined a convent. That's what these people did, and they look like such nice people. Now, I didn't believe in God. I threw him out with Santa Claus because that's all he was. I didn't believe in anything, really, when I went to college. After I married, I took the subjects that my husband, who was still a graduate student, was teaching in. He was in biology and zoology, so I took a lot of science courses, and I had just enough knowledge to support my atheism. I really didn't believe in anything. So you can imagine what these 12 steps meant to me at this point. I tore them up and threw them away, and I did just exactly what good old Charlie had said. I went over to the beach, and I had a ball. I also had an illness, a progressive illness, and I didn't know it. I had good jobs. I worked as a secretary, and I took a lot of dictation, and I was drinking a lot. And if you haven't tried to take dictation with the shakes, you just don't know what hell is. This was just an everyday thing of trying to get through and write without going to pieces. And finally, I got so upset that I couldn't sleep, so I went to the doctor for my nerves, and he gave me Seconal. Now, if you're not going crazy fast enough, just mix a little barbiturates with your booze, and this will help it along real well. Well, of course, this was before the days of tranquilizers. I don't guess I'd ever had a chance if they had been in then. But I was going around with the drinking crowd and a lot of the people who were down there on vacation, and I was trying to work, and I was staying up late, and I would take my second off, and then I couldn't get awake in the morning. So somebody told me about Benzedrine that would wake you up. And then I would be so shaky when I would go to work that I couldn't make it. And I'll never forget the first morning that I stopped in a bar, because this is something an alcoholic did and I didn't do. But I lived in South Miami, I worked on North Beach, and I changed buses in Miami, and when I got off that bus, I was going to pieces, and I knew of a little bar that people said opened at 7 in the morning. So I walked right straight down the street and sort of saddled in, you know, like so nobody could see me. And when I went looked around, there sat a buyer from Burdine's that I knew, and there was a lawyer that I knew, and a couple of other people, and they said, "Well, hello, Mary, welcome to the Breakfast Club." And I thought, well, this can't be so bad. So I remember that bartender looking at me and saying, "My, you're in bad shape. I know just the right thing for you." So he fixed me a herbicide sour. Now, this tastes and smells like licorice. And he fixed it in a tall stem glass and his soda rounded over, and he sat it there. And I thought, well, what will I do? I could no more pick that glass up than anything. And I sat there, and I looked at it, and finally I got down like this and slurped it up until I could get it up to my mouth. I took a couple of those, and every little nerve just behaved itself. I felt marvelous. I got on the bus, and I floated over to work, and I took the dictation, and I thought, what a fool I've been. I've been suffering all these years. I had it made. I had Seconal to go to sleep, Benzedrine to wake up, Herbicent to get to work, to get me through to lunch when I could have some martinis till 5 o'clock so I could do my drinking till I went to bed to take my Seconal, and around I went. I didn't forget which way I was going, up or down. They had an entertainer down there then named Harry the Hipster, and he had a song called I'm taking Benzedrine in my Ovaltine. And I thought, well, this describes my situation just exactly. Even I had to admit that I had a problem. And there was no doubt in my mind what my problem was. My problem was having to work for a living. This made sense. I wasn't getting into any trouble. I was a very amiable drinker. I wasn't getting in any trouble at all. It was just from 9 in the morning to 4:30 in the afternoon that I had problems. And I looked around at other people and other friends of mine who didn't have to work, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. Why should I have to work? Well, I couldn't think of any way out of it because I had no money. Except maybe if I could marry a rich man. This would solve all of my problems. Well, you know, funny thing, when we start out after something, it seems to meet us halfway. And I met a man, a very attractive rich man. I thought he was rich. He acted like it. He spent money like wine. And I thought, now, I must be clever because I imagine there are a lot of women in Miami who are looking for rich husbands. And I'm going to be real smart. I'm not going to let him know that I'm interested in his money. I'm going to act like I have money. Well, you know, I dropped a few remarks about the old home place in Kentucky and cost of the paint for the white fences, and my job was just sort of a stabilizer, and I didn't know how true that was. But anyway, it worked, and we were married. Now, this will show you the state of my mind at this time. I didn't realize that when I married this man, I was going to have to live in South Bend, Indiana. Thousands of miles away from everything that I cared about. He had a wonderful job with Bendix, and he traveled all over the United States and Canada, and he spent 2 or 3 months in Miami, and I had just assumed that we would live in Miami. But we didn't. We went to South Bend. But that wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing was he didn't have any money. He had deliberately misrepresented himself. And what I mistook for wealth was an unlimited expense account. And when he saw my bank balance, he was just as unhappy as I was. And he moved me into a little three-room apartment in his mother's house, and he went on traveling all over the United States and Canada. And there I sat, furious at what fate had done to me. But, you know, I had gotten just what I had bargained for, really, because I didn't have to work. I didn't have to get up in the morning. I didn't have to cook. I didn't have to eat. I didn't have to go to bed. I didn't have to do anything but drink. And my drinking took a decided turn for the worse, because now I no longer bothered to eat. Up until then, I always ate, because alcoholics don't eat, but I ate. But I didn't then, because there was no routine to my life. I didn't know anybody in South Bend. I wasn't about to meet anybody. And I sat, and I have never known such loneliness in my entire life. I did nothing but drink. I know one night I got to thinking about those AA people down in Miami. I had thought about them quite a bit. About 3 years had lapsed since I'd gone to that meeting. And I went to the telephone directory there in South Bend, and I looked in, and sure enough, there was Alcoholics Anonymous listed. So I was pretty drunk, and I called up, and some man answered, and I said, "I'm sitting out here in my apartment having a few drinks, and I wondered if you have any members who are drinking who would like to join me." He said, "Are you having fun?" "Oh, yes, I'm having a ball." And he said, "Well, I don't think then you'd want to drink with any of our members, because our members no longer have any fun drinking. Now, if you get to the point where it's no longer any fun for you, why don't you call me back?" Wasn't that a wise man? 2 weeks later, I called back. Same man. My husband had come home for the weekend. There was a terrible scene. I didn't even bother to go to bed. I just sat and drank. All I was trying to find was oblivion. I still had a bottle of Secanols, about 12 capsules, I guess, and I was running out. And I didn't know where I was going to be able to get any more, and I was beginning to be frightened. It was also beginning to take quite a bit of money to keep me in booze. And all I did on these particular weekends was just try to pass out, but I'd gotten to where it was very difficult to do. So this weekend, after we had had the scene on Saturday night, I just didn't bother to go to bed. I sat in the living room all night long and drank. The next morning, he got up, and he came in, and he took one look at me. He went back in the bedroom. He dressed. He packed his bag. He came back through, and he looked at me with all the loathing in the world. And he said, "It's quite evident that you don't give a damn about anything in the world but a bottle of whiskey. And I believe that you would do most anything to get it. Now, I'm leaving. I'll be back in 2 weeks. And I would appreciate it if, in the meantime, you would remove yourself from the premises. And he walked out the door. I don't think anybody had ever talked to me like that. If they had, I never did hear it. But I heard that. And, of course, my first reaction was to be furious. And I went back into the kitchen and took a drink. But a strange thing happened that morning. The body was drunk, but the mind wasn't. There wasn't any bounce. The drink didn't do anything. And I sat there, and I thought about what he had said. And the only way I can describe that morning is I've read about when people are drowning, their whole life unrolls before them. And this was what happened to me on that Sunday morning. This is what I suppose they mean when they write about the moment of truth. This was the first time that I admitted to myself that I married this man so I could drink. You know, we don't do things that way. This little rationalizer works things out for us, and we have all sorts of reasons and excuses for why we do things. But the rationalizer, I think, must have been drunk that morning because it wasn't working. And I thought, no, that's why I'm here, so I could drink. And I thought back over my life, and I had to admit that since that night when I was 15 years old and took my first drink, that everything that I had done had revolved around drinking. I only knew drinking people. I only took jobs that allowed me to drink. I lived in places where I could drink. Everything revolved around the bottle. And it was true. And it was a horrible thing to see myself in this light. I loathed myself. I had no philosophy. I didn't believe in anything. I had one philosophy, if you would call it a philosophy. I thought, when things get too bad, of course you'll kill yourself. This was my insurance against old age, against illness, against anything that was going to happen to me. This was always in the back of my mind. But for the past 3 years, after I had been to that AA meeting, every time I'd think of suicide, up would pop AA. And that's all in the world it was, just an alternative to suicide. So that Sunday morning, I sat there for a long, long time. And then I went back to the telephone, and I called AA. And this same man answered, and I said, "It's no fun anymore." And he said, "I'll have someone there to see you." Those wonderful people in South Bend, Indiana. I didn't know anyone there. They took me over. They managed my life. They read my mail. I mean, I just put myself in their hands. I didn't get any sense out of the meetings, but the only thing that got to me were here were people who were interested in me. And I had been so lonely for so long that I couldn't believe that there was really a group of people who cared. They came by and got me. They took me to meetings. I went to meetings every night. This was the only hour in the day that had any meaning at all. They brought me books to read, and I don't know, I still had this thing up here about any of this religious business, but they were very nice. They kind of wove around my sore spots, and they didn't push it. One very wise person said, "Mary, you can read books and you can hear people talk about God and all of this," and said, "it isn't going to mean a thing. The only way you're ever going to find out anything is to try it. Just try and see if there's a higher power." And about this time, I came across a book who gave this idea that there was a higher power, there was a force, and if we wanted to find it, to just give ourselves up to it, and it would take us over and revolutionize our lives. Well, about the only thing I'd gotten out of the program so far was that some people can't make it. Some people have gone too far, and they are not capable of making this program. And I thought maybe I was one of them. And I thought, I might as well go crazy this way as that way. I'll try it. So I did. I gave myself up to this higher power in a practical way. I asked for help to get a job, to take over, to keep me from shaking during the day. And it worked, just like they said it would. I think the best way that I can describe it is like when you're learning to float. Do you remember back when you were swimming and you wanted to learn to float? And how you'd fight, and the more you fought, the more you would sink. And you just think, I'll never do it. And suddenly you stop, and miraculously, the water supports you. And this, I think, is the only way I can describe what happens when we give up to this higher power. It supports us. I got enough support and strength to manage to take a job, and they sent me up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, to study, to learn to be a buyer. And this was something that was against my nature, because although I acted aggressive on the outside, I was really very shy and very unsure of myself on the inside. So I didn't throw away my second alls. I thought, now, you know, I've got to have something. You never know when something's going to happen, and you can't just be completely alone. So I kept that bottle of second alls, put them away somewhere, but I knew where they were, and I took them with me. And after a while, something did happen. They called me from Chicago, and they said, now you come in tomorrow morning and be here to talk to the heads of this company, and we're going to see about placing you someplace. Well, now, this was the type of thing I couldn't face. Sitting here, having these men talking to me and asking me questions. Well, I went to pieces just thinking of it. And I thought, thank God I have pills. I knew I wasn't supposed to take the pills. I thought, I really don't have any faith. What is this faith they talk about? And I took one of those little red capsules and I put it in the palm of my hand. And I said, well, I have absolute faith in this capsule. I know that if I take it, I'm going to be able to meet tomorrow whatever comes and sit there and talk to these people. Now, I have absolute faith in this capsule. And what these people are trying to tell me is that I am to have this same faith in something I can't see, hear, taste, feel, or smell. Something that I cannot perceive in any way. And suddenly this thing got very, very simple to me. All the philosophy went out the door. Everything left, and it was just, is it or ain't it? If there is such a power in this world, I want it more than anything that I have ever wanted or ever will want in my life. If there isn't, what difference does it make whether I shake or die or get drunk or what? It just simply doesn't matter. So either there is or there is not. And I'm going to find out. I took those 12 capsules. I took them in the bathroom, and I flushed them down the drain. And believe me, that took all the nerve I could find. And I thought, now here I am, naked, no protection, alone. And the only way I can describe what happened is to tell you that suddenly I was not alone. And I knew that I never had to be alone. This state lasted about 36 hours. I went in Chicago, and I remember as I walked down Michigan Boulevard, it just seemed that the lights all changed. I went in, I talked to these people. I've never experienced anything quite as vivid as that sense. I knew that for the rest of my life, I would never have to be alone, that yes, there was a higher power, and he would take care of me if I would but surrender to it. Now we say AA is a spiritual program. It's nothing but a spiritual program. In a way, this is quite true. But it's also a physical illness. And I had never accepted that. So I started going to meetings, and this was quite a few years. This is 1949, and in these smaller towns, there weren't many women. In fact, the town I went to in Ohio, there were no women. And most of the men were what we call low-bottom drunks. I mean, they had spent years in hospitals, and they'd been in jails, and some of them had been in prisons. And I went to the meetings, and I couldn't identify. And I thought, well, those things didn't happen to me. I'm no different from other people. My problem was that I didn't believe in anything. I had no purpose in life. I had no higher power. I was sailing without a rudder. I just was drifting. But now I did have a higher power. Now I could get along, and there was no reason in the world why I couldn't drink. After all, how did I know before I was a social drinker? I never tried it. I never heard the term till I came in AA, except something you check on insurance papers or something like that. It didn't mean anything. I didn't know there were any social drinkers. So I thought, I'll try drinking. 2.5 years later, in Lexington, Kentucky, married again to a wonderful man, somehow, by the grace of God, I managed to get back in this program. And tonight, when I stand here and talk about it, it scares me to death how I almost missed it. I finally realized there is something wrong with me. I am different from other people. I do have some sort of a reaction to alcohol. And there's only one hope for me. As long as I live, I must go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I must do whatever they ask me to do, right down the line, 100%. And so I gave myself up to this healing force. And this is the way I see it. It's a healing power that we get here in this program. It heals every facet of our being if we let it. This is a slow process. This is a process of regeneration. And the way that I see that it works is as my character defects rise to the surface in the form of problems, I have my opportunity to work them out. The solution to the problem is always in the problem itself. You know, it's impossible for us to love. We talk a lot about love. But it's really impossible for us to really love anybody until we can love ourselves. And it's impossible for us to love ourselves until we know ourselves and accept ourselves, all the bad along with the good. And this takes close observation and absolutely penetrating honesty. And few of us have this. This is something we must develop. This is something that happens slowly through the grace of this program. I know when I first came in to AA, it was a haven. It was a little place in the world where I was safe. I could no longer get along in the world. I was so hurt by all of the rejection. I was so crushed with all the violence. I was so unsure of myself. I was so completely insecure. And when I came into AA, I think we all experienced this. I'm accepted. I am understood. I am loved. I am safe. The world remained my enemy. Only in AA did I feel secure. I only went into the world when I had to, and then I came hurrying back into my little haven. And as the years passed by, something began to happen. I began to detect jealousies in AA. I began to see resentments in AA. I began to see ambition, power drives. I saw love, but I even saw hatred. I even felt rejection in AA. And my world was almost destroyed because I no longer had a haven. But by holding on to the principles of this program, I came through. And something happened. I found something. I found out who I was. I found out also that there is no haven in this world, that there is no security in this world except within ourselves. And with this, the barriers disappeared. And I learned that, of course, everything exists in AA that exists in the world because we're people. And then suddenly I realized I'm living in the world. I'm living in the world with all of its violence, with all of its wonderful love and warmth, with all of its coldness and hatred, with all of its rejection. I'm living in it. But I don't have to drink. And this is it. Thank you.